Chapter 11, SNL, 1991-1992. The summer after my first full season, I was back driving around Los Angeles in my used Acura Legend waiting to find out if I was going back. I had gotten rid of my dinky New York apartment on the corner of 85th Street and West End because I couldn't get anyone on the show to tell me if I was going to be hired back 3 months later. In hindsight, this all seems very stupid to me. It was such a hassle to move all of my shit out of my apartment, get it back to L.A., then find a place back in New York that I could rent month to month, wait for the cable guy, find a new bed, rehang the autographed picture of myself on the fridge, blah, blah, blah. It was never worth it. If I thought for 1 second I'd be somewhat famous or have any amount of money one day, I would never have lifted a goddamn finger and just rolled the dice and hoped for the best. Those just add to the intangible but somewhat tangible things that make Saturday Night Live a stressful place that drives people nuts. I finally got the call to come back, which was a huge sigh of relief professionally and personally. I was very driven at that time and wanted to do well in the field that everyone told me not to pursue. I had such a massive chip on my shoulder about being an underdog from Arizona with no showbiz connections. I had to see how far I could get. Add to that the fact that I hated disappointing the people that were trying to hang in there with me back home. I'd get a lot of calls from friends and other comedian buddies saying, "Dude, I waited up," which meant they stayed up all the way to the end of the show hoping to catch me once and got nothing. Sometimes I'd go on stage at the end when the host and the band waved goodbye, just so that people would see that I hadn't been fired. I used to joke with Farley that some weeks I counted that as a sketch. I'm like, oh, I'm in one thing, the good nights. We launched our first show with none other than the G-O-A-T greatest of all time, Michael Jordan, that season. He was an upbeat, fun dude, but also very intimidating, obviously. It was business as usual, the first show back with me appearing in one sketch with one line. Actually, it wasn't even a line, it was a reaction shot, which I counted as a line. The sketch took place in the 1960s, and we were a shitty all-white basketball team that was very resistant to adding Michael Jordan to our roster because he was black. No one would pass the ball to Jordan, even though he's clearly the best guy on the team. It was all very funny. At halftime, Michael gave an impassioned speech about teamwork until Mike Myers told him, "We don't want you on the team." Taken aback, Jordan looks, "You guys all don't really want me on the team?" And then he looked at me and said, "Even you, Pee-wee?" And I quickly averted my eyes in shame. It got a laugh, that little tiny rush of adrenaline. I wanted to run to Lauren and say, "Look, Lauren, I got a laugh without even saying anything. I'm magical. Sign me for 40 years. But I opted against it. Instead, I just wrote it in my diary. One thing that stands out most about Michael Jordan hosting SNL is how many people wanted his autograph. I'd never seen such a frenzy. There was a line outside of his dressing room. It was the cast, the writers, the crew, everyone. We were all supposedly cynical and cool, but I remember seeing Al Franken standing there holding 3 basketballs to sign. Finally, Lauren had to put a stop to it. It was the only time I can remember that a sign had to be posted at 30 Rock that said, "No more autographs," right outside his dressing room. How embarrassing. I was waiting to get a picture at the end of the week. My strategy went out the fucking window. Our next host was Jeff Daniels. Jeff is one of those everyman types that is sometimes hard to write for because he's such a talented actor, but he blends in a bit, you know? It can be hard to find the right angle to hang a sketch on, which I'll take any excuse I can get because I can't write. He's not super handsome, so you can't do that. He's not the fat guy. He's not angry, pushy, doesn't have an accent, doesn't have a huge hook. So he seemed destined for sketches that had him cast as the husband in a family bit or the host of a game show. But we tried, of course. Unfortunately, what could have been a pretty straightforward week turned into something pretty traumatic in the office of 30 Rock, makeup room specifically. Ooh, do I have your attention? On the Friday before the show, Jeff was scheduled to get a face mask done. For those of you who've had this done, it can be a terrifying experience. They even tell you that. If the makeup department wants to make a dummy that looks like you, or there needs to be a shot of your head blowing up, a plaster-like substance is poured onto your face to create a mold that can be used to sculpt a replica. This process is nerve-wracking and plays on all our primal fears. I've had it done, and I totally freaked out. First, a stocking cap is placed over your hair to make it smooth. Then this white crap that looks like Bisquick gets spread all over your face. 2 straws get jammed up your nose so you can breathe because your mouth gets covered with this goop too. I had been warned that the worst part is when your ears get covered. I said, "Hey guys, I'm not a pussy, even though I am. I get what's going on." So when the time came, I said, "Just go slowly, I'm not going to freak out." I realized what was happening, and I started taking deep breaths to get ready. I was okay when they covered my eyes, but then again, as if the makeup artist were talking to a little child, they'd say, "We're going to cover your ears. Don't freak out." I go, "Guys, I get it. I don't care. Just do it. I'm a hard ass." About 5 seconds into it, I got a rush of anxiety and I started freaking out. I demanded some Valium, which of course everyone had because clearly this was a common occurrence and everyone in show business is a drug addict. So they stuffed a pill down my gullet before they closed it up with plaster. It took everything I had to calm myself down enough to let them finish and then wait the 15 minutes it takes for the plaster to harden. It's hard to explain why the freakout happens so often, but I think it's because your body goes into panic mode thinking you're being buried alive. That's all I can figure. I'm stupid, but who cares about me? Anyway, for some sketch, we needed a Jeff Daniels doll. He was told to show up at 7 p.m. in the makeup room for the face mask process. This woman named Liz would walk the host around. She handled the talent. She'd take him from A to B because the fucking host doesn't know what he's doing. It's just like, go here, go here, go here, go here. As the story goes, the makeup artist put the straws up his nose and slowly applied the pancake batter as usual. He was very cool about it. When they covered his eyes, ears, and mouth, he didn't freak out, knowing he didn't have a big choice in the matter. I guess he wasn't a full-on pussy like me. After waiting 15 minutes for it to harden, the makeup artist started to try to peel it off. Here's where the fun comes. It's usually one hard, sticky piece they pull back. It feels pretty gross, like your skin is being taken off. Well, not this time. After a few minutes of struggling, it became clear there was a major problem. That wasn't makeup on Jeff's face. It was some kind of actual real plaster. There was a huge fuck-up. Everyone started freaking out, went into panic mode. This shit was not coming off his face. Everyone started yelling at him so he could hear beneath the plaster, "Don't worry, Jeff, just a few more minutes." Even though they knew this was not true at all. Some people snuck off to call Lauren at dinner and ask something to the effect of, "What the fuck do we do, boss? This guy will croak." Lauren called a plastic surgeon to come down to 30 Rock to suss out the sitch. By the way, it had been about a half hour at this point, and Jeff Daniels now realized something had gone terribly wrong. He wrote on a piece of paper, "I'm feeling sick," and in return, he got this little nugget. "Don't throw up, or you'll die. The puke has nowhere to go. You'll choke." "Thanks, that's comforting." 2 hours later, the plastic surgeon gets there. They peel the plaster off Jeff's forehead as far as it will go, but his eyebrows and eyelashes are stuck in it, in the goop. Doing the grimmest, most bleak move possible, but the only option, the surgeon sticks an X-Acto knife down the front of the mask and carefully cuts off his eyebrows and eyelashes so the doctor can get the plaster off the rest of his face. OMG alert. I can't imagine the relief and the pain Jeff must have felt at that point. Evan was worried that the show might get canceled the next day. Daniels was probably traumatized. They fixed him up medically and sent him home. To his credit, and the reason I think he's a stud to this day, is that he showed up the next day into the whole show without being a drama queen, which is called for when there's actual drama, and he didn't sue or bitch or talk about it incessantly like I for sure would have. He just showed up, bust his ass through every sketch like nothing happened, did a great job. If you watch that old show, you can see his eyebrows were painted on. It was all makeup. To this day, it is still a mystery how that mix-up happened in the makeup department. I have my theories. They involve George Bush, 9/11, Saddam Hussein, and some people from Mars, I can't say who. That season, I had another chance to trot out one of my favorite impressions, the old standby from the suitcase days, Tom Petty. I was pretty excited to meet the dude in person. I even thought he might be excited to meet me since I had been doing this impression for years. I forgot that sometimes impressions aren't 100% flattering, so the person being imitated might not be head over heels in love when they see it. Being the genius sketch writer I am, I couldn't think of a sketch that would include an impression of him. Here I had a chance to do one of the three killer impressions in my arsenal and I was blowing it. I say three because that's a pretty low number. I should have at least 10 on SNL, but I was a little light in that department. Luckily, I made up for it with snarkiness. Said like a used car salesman. Get your snarky here. So on Wednesday night after read-through and a shocking turn of events, I had nothing in the show. I spent the next 2 days wandering around the halls watching everyone else work on their sketches like little elves while I took my place as the resident loser. During the dress rehearsal, I had a bit of a brainstorm while sipping on an Amstel Light. I ran up to Tom Petty's dressing room with my beer balls, and I said, "Hey, can I talk to Tom?" Unlike Patrick Swayze, his people let me right in. I said, "Tommy boy, here's my pitch. I've been a fan of yours forever, and I actually do an impression of you." It's totally unflattering. I didn't say that part. "I've done it on the show. Is there any way when they go to commercial on the live show, you and I can sing together? They always cut to that boring G.E. Smith playing guitar for 30 seconds or however long they need to kill before a commercial. I think that should be us." He stared at me for a second, then leaned over to pick up his guitar and said, "Yeah, sure, what song?" I was like, holy fuck, this dude's going along with it. I said, "Well, I can't really sing, I just make noises." And he goes, "What about Breakdown?" I go, "I love Breakdown, but it's got too long of an intro. We have about 30 seconds here to play with." I said, "How about I Need to Know?" And he goes, "Hey, let me see how that goes again." He starts strumming on his guitar, which of course puts me in fangirl mode because it was so cool. Then he goes, "There's 16 bars and then you come in." I go, "Well, I don't know how that works because I don't know music. Can I just start with the words and then you jump in and follow?" And he goes, "Yeah, sure, we'll figure it out. I'll just follow you." And then to make things even cooler, Ben, his keyboard player, said, "Hey, can I play with you guys?" Meanwhile, in my drunken haze, I have not run this by one person from Lauren's office. This is fully unauthorized, but put an Amstel Light and a Half in me and get the fuck out of the way. I'm on a mission. My only snag, aside from breaking all the rules, was the one mercy line that was thrown at me in a sketch after read-through. I guess somebody felt sorry for me. So depending on where the sketch fell in the show, my master Tom Petty plan should have gone off no problem. And in pure spade fashion, it turned out to be a problem. The band shot, as they call it on the rundown, is usually scheduled before a commercial. The camera pans from the actors at the end of a sketch over to the band jamming until commercial break. These are strategically placed throughout the show. On this particular evening, there was only one band shot, and it happened to be right after the sketch I was in. When I drunkenly bombarded Tom Petty with this idea, I had forgotten I had one line in the show. Now I realized while timing it out, I probably had 60 seconds to do my line, run around the corner, throw on my Tom Petty hat, glasses, sideburns, fringe jacket, and get settled before the live band shot started. I had to run around during the live show and tell the actual band what was going on, then Tom Petty where to stand, basically tell everyone what was happening but Lorne. Tom and I decided I would start right at the beginning of I Need to Know, right when the red light went on the camera, meaning we were live and it was on me. I informed the cameraman that instead of panning over to me, just cut to me when the sketch was over. So I did my sketch, nailed my line, debatable, and sprinted over to the band. As soon as I was off camera, I threw on all the shit. My heart was pounding. I'm terrified to sing. More terrified Lauren is going to rip me a new one. Tom Petty walked out holding his guitar. He looked at me with an eyebrow that was like, "Are you ready?" I realized we probably should have run this in rehearsal because I have no idea what to do next. Before I knew it, the camera turns to me, red light goes on, and I instantly go, "Will the talk on the street is my God solo!" in my best shitty Tom Petty impression. Then I heard Tom Petty kick in with a guitar that I'm so familiar with, and I jumped on the second line. "Will a good friend of mine saw you leaving on your back door?" And more guitar, adrenaline, crazy. Now the chorus, "I need to know." And bless Tom Petty's heart if he didn't jump in the background. "I need to know." Backed me up like a stud. We went back and forth for another 10 seconds. Red light went off. We were clearly at a commercial. I stepped back from the mic and Tom pointed at me and said, "Keep going." I leaned forward. We belted out the rest of the song for the audience. We did the whole thing. It was horrible. Well, I was horrible, but it was such a blast. I felt like I was really in a band for a second. I see why guys like to be in bands. It was super fun. At the end of the show, I even scurried up for the good nights because I felt like I'd added something to the show that night. Surprisingly, Lauren never said a word about it. A few shows after that, Macaulay Culkin was the host. This is when I finally developed my encounter with Patrick Swayze's publicist into a sketch. The germ of the idea was that I was the assistant to the celebrity, which is always more important than the celebrity in Hollywood. The assistant has the keys to the kingdom. If you want to talk to a famous person, you have to get through them first. I made my editor work with my assistant on this book. I've never even met her. I didn't know how to frame a sketch or who I was going to play yet. A publicist, an agent, I didn't really know what to do. Finally picked personal assistant. Then I needed a setting. I decided on a waiting room at an office. That's where an assistant would be alone with the people waiting to meet a very important person, where he could privately pull his power trip. I didn't know who to make the star, but I thought it was funny to make somebody not super famous or obvious. For some reason, I chose Dick Clark. I don't even know why. I must have just seen him on New Year's Rockin' Eve or some bullshit that year and decided to go with him because he was a guy that was powerful but not like Jeffrey Katzenberg or some studio head, so it would be a little more frustrating if his assistant was talking down to you. This is the week I made my move to do my own sketch, writing myself in the lead. To give myself a better shot, I decided to use the musical guest. David Bowie was appearing on the show that week with his band Tin Machine. I knew Bowie had acted before, and I figured he'd be perfect because, well, he's David Bowie, and that's a huge star, and therefore unbelievably famous and easy to recognize. It would be a great scenario if Bowie couldn't get in to see Dick Clark because of some asshole assistant. So I wrote it up where Bowie comes into the office, I'm the receptionist, I stop him, I make him explain to me who he is, why I should know him, list his songs, list his credits, sing a little bit of it. I typed this whole thing up, well, the girls that typed it, and I gave it to the talent department. They told me, we'll try to get this to David Bowie, he's on the road. The next day I came in and there was a lone message in my tiny little mailbox written on yellow NBC letterhead that said, you missed a call from David Bowie. My heart stopped. I missed a fucking call from this legend. Holy shit. By the way, Sandler, Farley, we all loved seeing those little mailboxes filled with fan mail as we got bigger and bigger. That was a really, really fun part. They'd cram in those little yellow things from NBC, and then they'd cram in fan mail. And you could tell who was big. Mike Myers was squirting out the edges. The return number for David Bowie was a Boston hotel room with a fake name. And I can't give you guys this. This is between me and David Bowie. Anyway, I called Donkey Dick Magoo, or whoever. I remember I didn't call him until I was alone in my apartment and I had my balls going. I couldn't do it at the office for fear of saying the wrong thing and having Farley or Sandler come bust my balls, or worse, interrupt me and jump on the phone. I nervously poked at the keys in the old school push button phone in my house. Beep, boop, bop, boop, beep, beep, beep. Every girl that's 25 is like, what the fuck is he talking about? By the way, back then, you actually knew people's phone numbers by heart. Oh, yeah. Old man alert. I asked for his room, and David Bowie answered. Well, I didn't plan on this. I didn't plan anything. I was just winging it. Luckily, he was very nice. David, I read your sketch. It's hilarious. I have to do this. There's a reason I never did David Bowie on the show. I can't sound like him. Well, I got a shot of adrenaline when he did this. He goes, I come back tomorrow, so let's rehearse this thing and get it going. I was like, great, this will be fun. In my head, I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm doing a sketch that I wrote on SNL with David Bowie. Then came the carpet yanking out. Just one thing, I want to play the receptionist. So who do we get to play me? Do you want to? My heart stopped. Oh, fuck. What? Wait, what? Shit, what was I going to do? I was hoping to get a sketch on that I felt could finally help me gain some footing. What do I do? I can get a sketch on right now and gain some ground at work, or keep waiting and try to get it going with a future host. Ba, 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 ah, 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 ah. I took the latter. I explained to David Bowie that the receptionist was a character I wanted to own, like Wayne from Wayne's World, and I wanted to build on it over multiple shows, and therefore I couldn't just hand it over, because I was hoping to make it a running thing. And he said, well, it's not fun just playing myself. I could tell he was a bit annoyed, and I got it. But I knew he was when he told me he had to go and he hung up the phone. I was stunned. Couldn't believe I'd been able to talk to David Bowie, and then within 4 minutes, sort of piss him off enough to hang up so fast. God damn it. And so much my sketch idea. I spent another week getting paid by SNL for doing jack shit, basically. But this is life in the big city, like my dad had told me. That was rich, of course, coming from the same guy who had skipped town all those years ago on my mom. It's hard to take advice from a guy who can't handle life in the small city. With the receptionist sketch already written, I just needed someone to plug into it. The next week's musical guest was MC Hammer, so I decided to roll the dice with him. To be honest, he wasn't exactly what I had in mind, but he was super famous at the time, and it made sense. I reworked it from the David Bowie setup, but there's the basic jokes. The receptionist, me, wants to embarrass the star. I asked them to recite their resume, act out scenes from movies, blah, 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 to jog my memory. And then, of course, I shut them down no matter what. These are all the things that really happened in Los Angeles. And as such, the sketch got big laughs at read-through. I was so close to the finish line. The sketch just had to play well in front of the audience and dress, and it would make it to air. I found out between dress and air the sketch did make the cut, but it would be the last sketch of the show, the 5-to-1 sketch. I couldn't have cared less, but I didn't bother calling anyone home to say to stay up, Because the issue with the 5-to-1 sketch is that the show expands or contracts according to how big the laughs are in a particular audience. So if the crowd is great and the other sketches are great and they get big laughs, the final sketch usually gets cut during the show. That is why the last sketch is referred to as cut bait. Lingo! Use it! You never want your sketch to be referred to as cut bait. Well, luck was on my side. We made it on. Hammer was great and the sketch made an impact. We got laughs. This was days before Twitter and Instagram was invented. Maybe weeks. Actually, 15 years. So we couldn't get word of mouth out other than literally word of mouth. I got good feedback from friends and people I ran into. But as Lauren says, that kind of thing doesn't count. They always tell me that. One of the wise things Lawrence tells each cast member early on is that people will tell you you're the funniest person on the show. You're not. That kind of cold reality takes your legs out from under you, even though it's completely true. Everyone did tell me I was the funniest person on the show, and I wasn't. But even Lauren got good feedback on this sketch, and I heard from other cast members and writers. I felt so relieved to finally have a sketch under my belt that worked. I finally felt like I was part of the team, not just an observer. Naturally, I wanted to do the sketch again as soon as possible, but I had to give it a little breathing room. 5 weeks later, Roseanne Barr was hosting, and lucky for me, she was game. She's a good comedian. She got the jokes. Phil Hartman also joined her playing Jesus, and the 1-2 punch of those made the sketch crush pretty well at read-through. Sketch did so well at dress rehearsal that it got moved up to the very first sketch after the monologue, the point in the show where there's the most viewers. That's the most important sketch. Anything on before weekend update is solid because that's when we have a big tune-out problem. This was my best week on the show to that point. The sketch got better every time it ran, and it did so good once it got on air that for once I felt like I actually might spend the summer not worried about getting fired. Well, that feeling didn't last long. By the end of my third year, I was again on the chopping block. Word was, they weren't sure. Nothing I did after my Roseanne receptionist sketch landed on the air. The stress was getting to me. My neck hurt, my jaw hurt from grinding my teeth into a fine powder at night. I wasn't sleeping well, and I was very thin because of my lousy diet of pizza and pussy. I say pussy because it sounds funny, because there's two P's, but I wasn't getting any action. Stressed-out writers slash barely performers aren't as sexy as they sound, especially around the mean streets of New York City. I'm pretty sure I didn't eat a single vegetable my entire Saturday Night Live career, and I'm not lying. I probably had some level of malnutrition. My hair turned brown from being in New York for so long. I never knew my hair could be any other color but really, really blonde and fluffy in that juicy Farrah Fawcett, Pam Anderson way I'd always known. But I had spent my whole life in the sunshine of Arizona and then L.A., but 6 months in dreary, sunless, creaky midtown Manhattan buildings made my blonde hair brown. It sounds like a horrible Crystal Gayle song, but it's true. I wondered if I should just pack it in. This was too fucking brutal. Chapter 12, SNL 92 to 93. The summer of 1992, I was still on thin ice. All my pals were killing it. Schneider had scored with the Copy Guy skit. Sandler was creating one awesome character after another. Chris was on fuego like crazy. We were all doing gigs to make extra cash. But that year, Adam's road price shot through the roof. Your road price is another way to know how you were doing on SNL. Dana Carvey's was huge at that point. Adam, Rob, and I always made about the same price for stand-up gigs the first year we started on the show. But ours all started to creep up, and then Adam sort of passed up and went on further. Eventually, he started to double my rate. We'd go on the road together, but he now closed the shows. He was clearly a bigger draw, and it was slightly humiliating, but I chose to look at it from the perspective that I'd never made this much money on the road before, let alone in my life, and I knew tons of comics that weren't making shit, so I was pretty fucking lucky. It's hard to keep that attitude while you're on Saturday Night Live. It's a very much a culture of comparison. You look at what your peers have and what you have, and you are constantly doing the math to see who is on top or even the same. It's almost impossible to avoid all this shit. But you have to try if you want to stay sane. Take my advice, young SNL wannabes. I'm just as competitive as the next guy, but if you handle your competition like a dick, you'll end up ruining your career and your friendships. At the time, though, it was a bitter pill to watch all my pals doing so well. Well, I was doing good, but I was having a harder time. And I can admit it, and it's hard to admit, I think it's just a natural feeling. You want to be the best everywhere. Got into this to be good. you're at the worst spot on the best place. By late summer, I still didn't know if I was going to be invited back to the precious show. The only thing I'd done of note in the previous season was the fucking receptionist sketch, but that didn't seem to blow the fucking minds off the roof of the house. That's a new saying. That and being fun around the office is about all I had going for me. And even that I wasn't always sure about. Chris, Rob, Adam, maybe Norm, Timmy Meadows. There's a lot of people that had gotten their calls already. Once again, I had to sweat it out longer than anyone else. At some point in early August, one of my managers talked to Lauren. He told me, he's bringing you back, but you really have to work hard. And you're still going to be a writer, feature player. This was disappointing to me. Oh my God. Now I was the only chump in my class left slaving away at those fucking rewrite meetings. They were all full cast members. I mean, Farley basically was one since the day he started, but Rob got to get out of those meetings. Adam got, and those are my boys to hang out with. This also meant that none of their new writers would feel the responsibility to put me in their sketches. Why would they? I'd been treading water with minimal talent for a long time, and I didn't know how long it was going to last. Why write for me when you can write for those guys, or Dana, or Mike, or, you know, someone that'll for sure get on? The host of our first show that season was Nicolas Cage. I came out swinging hard, and like Reggie Jackson, I whiffed three times. Just not quite the home runs yet. I got nothing on the show at all, so I was off to my typical strong start of being invisible. By the way, this helped me later when I played the Invisible Man in Hotel Transylvania. I drew it from my real feelings. Next up was Timmy Robbins. This show was very important and memorable to me for several reasons. The first and most important reason is this is the show where I finally saved my ass on SNL. I was sitting at the writer's table on Monday, bored as usual, waiting for everyone to trickle in. I was reading People magazine out loud and basically shitting on every celebrity featured. Look at this fucking asshole, blah, 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 blah. Bob Odenkirk, bless his heart, was sitting near me and he goes, you got to write that up. And so the Hollywood Minute sketch was born. I was thinking about doing it as a talk show called Guess What? Guess What? You're an idiot. But it turned into Hollywood Minute. During that read-through, Lauren said to me, you found your voice. And that was the best fucking thing I could possibly hear. I could tell by the way he said it, he was happy, and I was actively saving my job in the process. The first Hollywood Minute bit went off without a hitch. The audience bought into it right away. A young loser nobody from Arizona taking out major celebrities at the knees. It was a good idea. It just sort of clicked from the very first burn. A new segment had been born for me, one that would become my best move at that place. This was the time when there was only People magazine. Don't forget, it was always fawning over these guys and no one was saying what they really thought. It was my great timing award because after that came Entertainment Weekly and blogs and where everyone was snooper snarky and shitting on celebs. So I really got in first on that. Or close to first. Show's also memorable for another reason. More unfortunate reason. See, Tim Robbins is a sort of political guy. He was hosting SNL and he wanted to make a statement. In the Monday meeting, he explained to all of us, I want to go after everybody in my monologue. All these big corporations, even GE, which is General Electric, which was NBC's parent company. Everyone sort of nodded, you know, and pretended we thought it was hilarious. But we went out of business writing sketches that didn't shit on GE, who pays our bills. Which Lauren doesn't really have a problem with that stuff. It's just there was no funny idea to it. It was just, I want to get these people. And everyone's got their own ideas, so it sort of fell apart. So during the monologue Saturday night, Tim Robbins went for it. He had someone help him, and he came up with his own stuff, whatever, but he made a few political statements. And he made some jokes. I recall him quietly singing the GE ad slogan, but changing the last bit to GE. We bring good things to death instead of life. The cast and the audience awkwardly laughed because, honestly, it was more of a comment than a joke. But he had done what he set out to do, and he was happy. I think he was hoping for some media or someone would pick up on that statement and run with it. And that might have happened, except about 20 minutes later, Sinead O'Connor came up to sing one of her dopey songs. If it wasn't Nothing Compares to You, I didn't want to hear it. I remember I was standing behind Lauren watching the monitor and sort of basking in the glory of my Hollywood Minute sketch doing well, waiting for him to put his arm around me and say, good job, son. And while I was there quietly begging for a snossage from him, I saw something odd on the screen. At the end of her snoozer tune, Sinead held up a picture of Pope John Paul and said, fight the real enemy, and ripped it into 10 pieces. The room fell silent. Oh, snap. No, she didn't. God damn, I wish I made that phrase up, because at that moment, that was the perfect time to bust it out. Uh-uh. I wish I invented snap, too. Or just snaps, like on your shirt. I'd be rich. I wondered the same thing everyone else in the cast probably did. Is this part of the show? Then she dropped the pieces of the Pope ripped-up picture onto the stage and nervously scurried away. The crowd was dead silent. It's the first time in SNL musical history that the guests did not get applause after their song, because no one knew what the fuck was going on. Lauren turned to me after sipping on his Amstel Light, shrugged his shoulders, and said, Irish. I had to laugh, even though I didn't totally get it. During the commercial, I walked out onto the stage, looked down at what was left of the Pope on the floor, and grabbed a piece. I stuffed it in my pocket. I thought, this will be a nice memento if anybody remembers this happening. Cut to the next day. This shit is worldwide news. People are freaking the fuck out. I really don't know much about religion. It wasn't part of our family culture at all. My mom didn't have time for church. We went now and then. We didn't go all the time. But she had to work, fight my dad for child support, never came, and just do actual shit. So I wasn't informed on every religion, what was going on. I didn't really get what the big deal was. All I knew is that Sinead O'Connor was kind of sexy when she got to the studio that week, so I sort of flirted with her. Then I decided at the end of the week, when she was a worldwide pariah, that I didn't want to sleep with her because that was sort of a major boner killer. And she shaved her head, and I had bought her a bunch of scrunchies, and it was all like gift of the magi. That Sunday night, while I was doing my piles of laundry in the basement of my dog shit apartment building, I watched Inside Edition. As my flannel shirts were drying, there was Deborah Norville yammering on about Saturday Night Live. I pushed my 2-foot stack of quarters to the side to get a better look, and saw that they were actually reporting on how Sinead O'Connor ripped up a picture of the Pope on camera, which they should have, because this was a big story. But then they put the torn pieces back together to make the photo whole again. I thought, oh, this is so corny, they're reenacting it. Well, when I looked closer, one piece was missing. My eyes slowly drifted over past the laundry machine quarters to that little slice of Pope I had snagged from the night before on the floor. I held it up to the TV screen, and it fit perfectly. Holy shit, Inside Edition had the actual photo that she ripped up. How did this happen? So I went to work, and I told a couple of cast members that I'd gotten a little piece of the Pope picture, bragging my fucking ass off. Sure enough, I got hauled into SNL producer Kenny Among's office. Kenny is a guy I love. He's always very cool to me during SNL, and now, even when I was a nobody, he was always there, and he was always cool to me. Just side note. But he sat me down with 2 security guards and said, you might have something that belongs to us. And being ever the smartass, I was like, oh, I don't think so, unless you're talking about a pile of bad sketches that never got on the air. Crickets. No one laughs. Security guard then goes, do you have a piece of the Pope picture? And I said, oh yeah, I guess I do. Who ratted me out? I still thought the situation was funny. I was clearly not reading the room very well. And then the security guy goes, do you have it with you? Of course I did, because I wanted to show it off and talk about anything but Joe Pesci's sketch ideas I had to write that day. It quickly became clear to me that I needed to hand that piece of picture of the Pope over, and quick. These guys were not messing around. I learned soon after that a member of the crew had stolen the ripped-up photo off the floor and sold it to Inside Edition for $10,000. He was fired, but security thought I might be in on it. Kenny knew I wasn't, but he had to follow protocol. We laughed about it later. And by laughed, I mean we should have split the $10,000. The rest of the season, I peppered in a few Hollywood Minute sketches, and I felt like I was officially on the radar. It took me way too long, but to be honest, by mid-season, I had the audacity to believe that I might be able to enjoy one summer without worrying about getting canned. We had a solid lineup of hosts that year, and ratings were good. I remember during February sweeps, the musical guests were like Bon Jovi, Madonna, Mick Jagger, Paul McCartney, Sting. Fucking crazy lineup. But in the 19th show of the year, I was part of the most memorable sketch of my SNL career. I had heard about the motivational speaker character here and there throughout the year. Farley and Bob Odenkirk used to talk about it a lot at the office. They discussed that in a sketch called Whale Boy. 2 ideas I guess they worked on at Second City and were trying to bring to SNL. Well, that week, Christina Applegate was the host, and they decided to put it out there with Chris in the lead. I almost threw in, and the rest is history. It's very corny, but for once, it's kind of true. Christina and I were cast as the two kids that the speaker had been brought in to motivate. Phil Hartman played our nerdy dad, clearly at his wit's end with his troublemaker kids and making a last-ditch effort to save him. This was the most tailor-made Chris Farley sketch ever. A fastball right down the middle that he could knock out of the park. It was physical, it was hilarious, and especially with his scratchy, hoarse voice, he made it even funnier. He slicked his hair back after seeing Christian Slater do it when he hosted the year before. He thought it was cool. And then he started wearing those massive Dan Aykroyd clunky-style reading glasses every day. So that became part of the costume. And it all came together with that horrible plaid blazer. Matt Foley was born. This was one of those bits where everyone on the floor of rehearsal was laughing every time he did it. It was bulletproof. There was no way it could go south because the more Chris stumbled, stammered, and squinted at the cue cards, the funnier it was. When we did it on the show, we were all prepped not to laugh. These are the days before Fallon and Horatio were losing their shit a lot in the air. And I guess Lorne loosened that policy, but he did not like us laughing in the sketches during our time. There was a very strict rule. We were not the Carol Burnett show. We must stay in character at all times. Of course, Chris didn't give a shit about those rules and did his best to make Adam or me or whoever laugh every single sketch we were in with him. He felt like it was a victory if he broke us, which it was. During some sketches, he would get close enough to me that he would headbutt me, just to throw me off. Of course, that worked every time. Other time, he would be facing me and cross his eyes, cracking me up with something the audience couldn't see. Like if he was sideways to the audience and they couldn't see the other eye, he would cross him. Or he would overly ham up a line in a way that had never been done in rehearsals and totally throw everyone off. It is now very well known that Christina and I totally lost it during that sketch. The thing that set me off was Chris twisting back and forth on his belt like Chubby Checker. He looked like a fucking idiot, and it caught me off guard. And then he did that running motion, and that was it. Once I started to crack, I knew he would come in for the kill, and he did. Christina and I didn't have a chance. She started going, I started going, I was trying to hide my face. Chris was going in harder, audience was into it. It all came together. Very funny. Rolling Stone called this the best sketch of all time, and I'm not sure if that's true because there are so many fucking great sketches. I will say Matt Foley is definitely one of the greatest characters to ever come on that show. I was very lucky that I had a front row seat for that. It's one of my favorite memories of Chris. We did Motivational Speaker probably 5 times, and the head writers were cool enough to always put me in it. My second favorite one is when he tries to speak Spanish, and he basically reads it phonetically off cards. The whole sketch, I think, is in Spanish. Se llama soy hombre Matt Foley. It's so dumb. The whole sketch was hysterical to me because in rehearsal, I just kept laughing and yelling, Chris, what the fuck are you doing? Pretend we're in the sketch with you. Look at us. He goes, shut the fuck up, David. And that pretty much turned into shut up, Richard and Tommy Boy, because he said it so much. During the season, Chris dated one of Lauren's assistants. We'll call her Erin, because that was her name. She was this sweet, preppy blonde girl, and we all thought she was very cute, very fun. Chris and Erin dated on and off for a while, but eventually called it quits for a myriad of reasons, I'm sure. But she did tell me once that she went back to Wisconsin with Chris and stayed at his childhood home with him. She was traumatized by dinner because it consisted of his dad bringing a big platter of steaks out and everyone just going at them like a bunch of crazed wolverines. Then Chris's mom carried around the yuck bag, and each man would spit his yucky bones into it and gristle, throw up. I busted Chris's balls about the yuck bag forever. We'd be at a really nice restaurant. I go, do you have a yuck bag, sir? And he's like, oh, what? And Chris's like, shut up, David. I couldn't believe how horrifying it must have been for this sheltered, waspy East Coast girl to see the Farley family go nuts at a family dinner with all the booze and bones flying around. A couple weeks after they broke up, word got around that Erin was dating someone else. Then we heard who the new guy was. We decided not to tell Chris right away. But one day he confronted me and Adam and he goes, I heard Aaron's got some new stupid boy toy. Did you guys hear about this bullshit? We were like, oh, yeah. Well, he might be better looking than me, but he ain't funnier. He's not richer, and he's sure as fuck not more famous. And we just stared at Chris for a few seconds in silence. Finally, I had to break it to him. We got some bad news, pal. You're 0-for-3. She's dating Steve Martin. Crickets. Then he was like, gah, fuck! Chapter 13, SNL 93-94. For the 93-94 season, I was finally a full cast member. Yada, da, 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 da. Wing! This is the joy of my audio tape version. True to my SNL employment pattern, I didn't learn this news until the very end of the summer, milking the shit out of it after a long, hot season of sweating bullets waiting to be fired. I was sick of this drill. I was excited to have finally taken the next step, but to find out so late was a bit embarrassing. I was bummed this year because Chris Rock was gone. By this point, we'd become very tight, and to be honest, he was frustrated. Saturday Night Live was never the perfect place for him. So he left the show and went back to his stand-up roots. 2 years later, in 96, he released the unbelievable stand-up special, Bring the Pain, and reminded everyone what the fuss was all about. He deserved that, and he busted his ass to do it. We were all stoked. It paid off huge for him. He was back on top. Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. I, on the other hand, was busy finding my fourth apartment on the Upper West Side and writing sketches about working at the Gap. Remember that little doozy? I had been home in Arizona once shopping at the Gap for some of their exceptional ringneck t-shirts when I overheard two chicks folding clothes. I sat there listening to one of them tell the other something along the lines of, "You're folding those cable crews wrong." "I know, I missed the folding meeting. I'm so dumb." "Oh my God, you're going to get so busted." Back and forth, back and forth. The girls themselves even laughed at how stupid their conversation was. That gave me the idea of a sketch of guys working at the Gap and having these asinine conversations mostly about the Gap. Then I thought it would be funny if we dressed in drag and played it as girls because this sounded like girls talking, but I wanted to do it for me. But we didn't play them gay because we thought that would be sort of a cheap way out. Might be funnier to play as actual girls. This wound up being a bit sticky because there were not enough parts for the real girls in the show already, and this sketch had parts for four girls being taken up by four guys. I decided not to worry about that and look out for numero uno because, according to my calculations, I was on air less than most of the girls anyway, and I had to remember the old "nobody said life was fair" motto. The other benefit of the sketch was it gave me a reason to hang out with Farley, Sandler, and Schneider all week. That made coming to work a little more fun. Our first host that season was Chaz Barkley. Charles Barkley was great because he was up for playing a girl with long dreadlocks. I wrote the sketch that we had a girl-girl hookup at a keg party during a game of Truth or Dare. Very edgy at the time. I also wrote a part in the sketch that had the Gap girls going to a Nirvana concert and that the band hits on them backstage. It was so stupid, but we had the balls to ask Nirvana to actually do it. On a side note, I'm still in shock I met Kurt Cobain. He was one of the most memorable, interesting people that came through that show. I sat down with the band at dinner break once, and they were all very cool to me. I sometimes feel like I have a kinship with Dave Grohl because both of the guys we were very close to got very famous quickly and then died. And we stuck around to field questions about them for the rest of our lives. It is an honor, but sometimes it's not so easy. The day before we were set to film the backstage segment, we heard from the music department that Nirvana was not going to do the sketch. I was all fired up, so bummed that my brilliant sketch was in jeopardy. "Why not?" I asked. "We didn't ask them." I stood in shock. "Why didn't you?" "Well, maybe because the sketch shows the band trying to date rape you and Adam backstage and their managers thought it wouldn't be super appropriate." I was like, "Oh yeah, I guess I could see that." But I still wouldn't give up. I liked the idea of us getting drunk and making our way backstage at a concert and having Adam run out moments later screaming, "He grabbed my boobs!" And I was like, "Where's my scrunchie? Just run!" Our shirts were half off. There was no way I was throwing away this award-winning scene. So we called the band Skid Motherfucking Row. And they were more than happy to come in from New Jersey and help us out. Lead singer Sebastian Bach and guitarist Rachel Bolan came over and played it perfectly. I'm sure Nirvana were kicking themselves when they saw this amazing piece of comedy air. The Skid Row guys were nuts, though. Super funny. When they were on the show, Sebastian Bach yelled, "We are live, motherfucker!" at the end of his song, which I thought was funny, especially on a show called Starting Out Live. No one broke the rules when they were at SNL. They weren't supposed to, but Sebastian did not give a shit. It wasn't even like they were Guns N' Roses or the Stones. They were a solid band. They had two good songs out at the time. I'm not even sure the swearing went out on the air. I thought it did, but I didn't hear anything about it afterwards. The other thing Bach did that was pure insanity was wear a t-shirt at the Goodnights that had a can of Raid on it with dead bugs around it. Everyone had seen the ad that said Raid, kills Bugs dead. As he was waving goodnight, I looked closer and realized, much to my shock, that it didn't say that. It said, AIDS kills fags dead. I was like, what? Wearing that shirt today would get you kicked out of show business immediately. In fact, you should just see yourself out if you wore something like that. But at that time, there wasn't much of a controversy over that, which seems shocking. And my God, I'm sure today Sebastian regrets wearing that, but thank God that's one style from the 90s that hasn't resurfaced at Urban Outfitters. After the Gap Girl sketch went well, I was all gung-ho to come up with another one. And one of them from this season ranks as the most top five most memorable sketches I appeared in during my SNL run. The first motivational speaker is probably on top, but I take zero credit for how great that one is. Anyone could have played that part. This was a Gap Girl sketch we did when Sarah Gilbert was the host. I decided to leave out the date rape part on this one. Farley made this one memorable, as he did to so many sketches, but at least I got to write what he said. The idea this time was that the Gap Girls went on a break at the mall food court and got into a heated argument with the girls from Donut Hut. Chris, Adam, and I were the Gap Girls again. Schneider and Sarah Gilbert played the Donut Hut girls. Clearly, there was a tense rivalry between these two factions, one that hadn't been seen since the likes of the Jets and the Sharks in West Side Story. Started out with us discussing current events and getting almost everything wrong. From calling carpal tunnel syndrome carpet tunnel syndrome to discussing the trial of the Menendez brothers. Then came the infamous fries joke, which was inspired by the fact that Chris always ate the fries off my plate whenever we were in a restaurant together. If you watch closely, you can see me mouthing everyone's lines as the sketch goes on. This happens a lot when you write sketches. You just want the jokes to work perfectly. So I was desperate for Chris not to fuck up the "lay off me, I'm starving" line because I wanted that to work so badly. But the real kick is the quiet "diet starts Monday" right after. I saw that quote on a meme recently, and I was so happy that something I scribbled 20 years ago on a wrinkled legal pad at a fucked up little wooden desk at 4 in the morning was still funny to someone today. After that, the girls from Donut Hut enter, and Sarah says, "Oh, there's the Gap Girls, and they're eating again. What a surprise." They continue to make fun of me because I'm dating a loser who doesn't really like me. Sample was like Adam going, "He's so mean to you. Doesn't he always tell you like you slept on your face?" And I go, "Yeah, he's just really honest." Adam goes, "What about that time you reminded him that he owed you $600 and he punched you in the neck?" I go, "He's just really sensitive. He's a cancer." Oh, there was another throwaway joke we put in to see if the audience would get it. It was a time lapse. When there's a time lapse in a sketch, the graphics department just puts up an exterior photo on the mall and says 4 days later at the bottom. Obviously, they come back to us and we're still sitting there from 10 seconds ago. So I added, "Isn't it funny that we're all wearing the same outfits from 4 days ago?" And Adam goes, "No, we're not." And I go, "Trust me, we are." People think I made it up that night, but it was planned, I'm sad to say. I did make it up at rehearsal and decided to keep it in. The last question I get about the sketch is that at the very end we say, "The Donut Hut girls are always OTR, and we laugh. Some people ask me over the years what that meant. In Arizona, when girls were bitchy, we said they were on the rag, and so I thought everyone knew what OTR meant. Apparently, it's not universal, but that's what I get being from Scottsdale. Another favorite that year was yet another sketch that involved me playing a smartass. Do we see a theme? It was on the show that Helen Hunt hosted, and we played rude flight attendant assholes. Fred Wolf, one of my longtime buddies and great writers on the show, had the idea about two sweet, blonde, all-American flight attendants standing at the door as everyone exits and saying the now infamous "buh-bye" to everyone as they left. The "buh-bye" is laced with some venom, so what you really hear is "get the hell out of here," which you know is what flight attendants are thinking after hours of taking care of hundreds of demanding assholes on an airplane. This has to be one of the worst jobs, especially when I'm flying, because I'm a dick. Hi, folks. This sketch had a great hook, and it was perfect for Helen Hunt and me. The audience related to it and responded to it very well because they've all seen those flight attendants in their own lives. Sometimes you'll notice something in the world that seems funny to you. This angle of escalating the "buh-bye" more and more was just funny to me. Fred and I were good buddies. He let me write it with him. We did it at read-through, and we laughed a ton during rehearsals because the sketch just got funnier and funnier as it went on. At the very end, when Sandler wanted to beat me up, and I kept going, "buh-bye," and he kept going, "I'm going to kill you." I'm like, "buh-bye." And how we replaced lyrics of the song from the 70s with "buh-bye," like, "aw, buh-bye," to the tune of "Freak Out" and "Do the Bye-Bye" instead of "Do the Hustle." He called the airline TBA for Total Bastard Airline. I was slightly surprised that got through standards and practices back in the day. The sketch really came together and did well on the air, but you never really know what's going to resonate. Again, without Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you can't really get a feel for what people liked. You had to go by what you heard from your friends and hopefully what Lauren heard from his Upper East Side pals. But I got on a plane the next day to head back to L.A. for a two-week break, and all the flight attendants were babaying the shit out of me. For the next 10 years, I have had babai said to me probably at least once a day. American Airlines even used the sketch in their training seminars to show the perception of flight attendants and how it needs to be changed for the better. Recently, I was leaving Burger King. Yes, Burger King, folks. Joe Dirt. And there were stickers on the door that said, "Buh-bye," in huge letters. Watching SNL as a kid, there are always those sketches, the catchphrases that became part of popular culture. When I got on the show, I wanted desperately to be part of one of those. All I wanted to accomplish when I left the show, that I'd be in one sketch and said a line that people repeated. I think that was the closest I came to that. After the receptionist, I got a lot of, "And you are..." But Bubbye remains the most repeatable and most remembered. What I also learned from that sketch is that people like what they like. We did that sketch once that season, and I heard about it for 5 years. Now, Dana and Mike did Wayne's World 25 times. It was a massive hit, created a million catchphrases. But my point is that there was something about that one sketch that people latched onto, and it became a little thing, you know? We even tried Bubbye one more time the following season, and it just didn't have the same vibe to it. Didn't catch on, wasn't that funny, we lost all the mojo, no one remembers it. But everybody remembers the first one. So we did it twice. We did Receptionist twice, maybe three times. You'd think we did it 50 times because of reruns, but the ones they like. Believe me, the ones they don't, they fucking don't. At the end of this year, Adam and Chris were about to go and take over Hollywood. I wasn't ready to leave yet. I'd just been made a full-time cast member, and I didn't have anything lined up, so I stayed another year. Lauren gave me a weekly 5-minute segment called Spade in America where I could do whatever I wanted. I really liked that, for once. I got to call the shots. But I sort of felt like I was back on the wall outside the high school cafeteria. I was the guy who graduated but couldn't quite get a life. Most of my squad was gone now, and it was Will Ferrell, Molly Shannon, Sherry O'Terry, a bunch of others. They took over. I liked Will a lot because, A, I thought he was hilarious. I remember I invited him to lunch one week, and like a selfish prick, I ate before he got there. He was so surprised that I had done that, and I felt like a big asshole after. Even though that is something I do with all my friends, all the time, it was sort of symbolic. My time was done there. I just thought it was weird. It was time to move on. I didn't do any sketches that year. Just did my bits. And then that was that. There's one bit from that year that I do want to talk about. It was a field bit that involved Sean Penn and a tattoo. At this point, I didn't know Sean Penn at all. But I had heard him talking at a party, and he was trying to learn how to do tattoos on potatoes or pig ears or whatever. I don't know why this stuck in my head or even if it's true. But a week later, I was desperate for an idea on the show again and read that Penn was in town for Letterman. So I had the brilliant idea to ask him to come in and give me a tattoo. Brought to you by dumbideas.com. I asked Lovitz for his number. Lovitz made me promise I wouldn't tell Sean where I got his number. It was like a chick. I left him a message saying who I was and asked if he would give me a tattoo when he was in town. He shockingly called me back later and said, "Sure, let's do it." He didn't seem too nervous about possibly ruining my upper arm for the rest of my life. So now I had to A, go through with this bit, and B, find a tattoo I liked. I found a tattoo based on the one Steven Tyler had on his arm, and I thought it was cool. I had it all drawn up and was ready to go. For legal reasons, we had to meet outside of Manhattan. I don't know why, so we had to send a car for Sean. For hours, I was in this grubby little tattoo parlor with a film crew, waiting for a guy I don't know to come destroy my beautiful epidermis. Actually, to finish the job the Arizona Sun had started. The owner was a big, burly, cool dude who actually knew Sean, and two other Hell's Angels guy were there to meet him for I don't know why. This was not my typical scene. I was a squirrely little punk from Arizona that was more comfortable sitting at Kona Grill waiting for a quesadilla. So I sat there awkwardly trying to jabber with these shady characters about feathering hair techniques or anything I could think of. At this point, Sean, who was 2 hours late, comes in. My driver got lost and reported he wanted some vodka, so they pulled over. To kill time, I filmed the owner giving me a tour of his fine establishment and me wisecracking about different tattoos. I'd see one, I go, oh, I'll get that one, and be like, tattoo, the plane, the plane. All my jokes were stupid. He never cracked a smile. Sean finally rolled in, what felt like hours later, slightly buzzed, but very nice, ready to go. I showed him the tattoo sketch I'd picked out, and he looked at me curiously, and the owner said, there's no way he can do this one. It's too complicated. So I go, what can he pull off? We ended up going through the comics section of the newspaper, and the one that was decided on was Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes. As much as I thought this was a mildly amusing comic, I definitely did not want to have that drawing on my arm for the rest of my life. But the show must go on. Sean started doing the tattoo while I interviewed him about his career and world events. I was trying to make him laugh over the buzzing noise and the pain. Not a great idea. He goes, you know, when I laugh, I'm even worse at this. This was not reassuring since he wasn't so great at it even when he wasn't laughing. At this point, I didn't care. I was already going to be maimed for life. I just wanted a good bit. When we were in the middle of the interview, I hit him with one of my meanest jokes. It was around the time Sandra Bullock was starring in the cyber thriller The Net. So after a few dumb jokes about his career, I said, hey, by the way, did you see the Talking Pig movie? And he goes, no. And I go, oh, you didn't see The Net? And he took a beat and smiled and said something to the effect of, that is fucked up. Looking back, maybe it was a little bit too rude to kick America's sweetheart Sandra Bullock in the balls because for one movie she was maybe 5 pounds overweight. But I had to get it in there and it cracked me up for some reason. Probably because it was so shitty and so out of left field. Anyway, I got back to the show and played the bit, and to this day, I don't think people thought it was a real tattoo. But if you ever see me at a beach and I'm flexing like a moron with Calvin on one of my mega guns, you'll see Sean's handiwork for yourself. Being valuable. I want to take an opportunity to say a few words here about Schneider. Robbie Schneider. I've written some things about him in this book. It's probably obvious that we were friendly rivals. Sometimes actually not that friendly. Sometimes the rivalry went only one way, as in I saw him as a rival while he was doing fine and riding high. I don't want people to hear this and think there's a lot of bad blood between us. Rob and I have many years of being in the trenches together, and all those shared experiences have given me some perspective on things. Robert Smigel is a great writer at SNL and still a buddy. I think it was said once during a period on SNL when there was a chance that Rob might be fired, said that he probably wouldn't because he was valuable. That phrase was something along the lines of, we shouldn't get rid of him, he's valuable. This was at a time when Rob was really rubbing folks the wrong way in the show. It wasn't just me. But when I heard that, I thought, valuable, that was a very interesting word choice. I didn't really even get what that meant in that context. I had to have it explained to me. What I thought was, here's a guy who can get Phil Hartman to throw him against a wall in anger. Here's a guy who has Jack Handy grousing about him. This guy is annoying two of the nicest people in the building, and yet he's valuable. That really stuck with me. I figured out later it meant because he's good at his job. At the end of the day, he's a good writer, he's a good performer, and he can add funny ideas and lines to existing sketches. So in a weird way, I thought, I want to be valuable. I was jealous of that. He actually brought more positive than negative to the table. By the way, his negative phase was an early phase, and I shouldn't be harping on it. Sounds like it was the whole time. It wasn't. There was a quick time there where it got a little dicey, and then everything evened out, and everything was back to normal. But this thing with Rob, I realized, was just a blip on the radar. The real big examples are the huge stars in Hollywood, like movie stars, rock stars, and how much shit they get away with versus how much money they're bringing in, or how much they bring to a project. You see it all over. I mean, athletes, everything. You can get drunk at work if you're doing a show that's making money. You can do everything wrong, like Charlie Sheen. But if you get your fucking lines right and someone makes money, people will give you a pass. Sheen's sort of a bad example because he did get shit canned. But then he jumped on another show and made someone else a ton of cash. And he really didn't change his tune at all. I try not to be a total disaster at work, but I do try to be valuable. I try to bring whatever I can to the table. I want whatever project I'm on to do well, so I will use everything in my power, from writing jokes for people to helping someone out to do this, be on time, all that shit. It's all very tricky now. It was very tricky back then. I sound like I'm slamming Rob, but actually I'm slamming myself. I had a lot to learn back then. I think we all did. Here's what I learned from SNL. When people are better than you, don't be jealous. I'm talking about literally almost everyone in that show was in some way better than me when I got there. You just have to respect it and use it to drive yourself to be better. I got into stand-up on a whim, but once I made the choice, I wanted to be great stand-up. So many people on the show were so much better than me, I couldn't deal with it at first. It takes a lot to be great, and I was surrounded by it. I felt like a good high school player that got moved up to the pros. But running with people better than you makes you faster, and that's what I got from SNL. It made a lazy guy work harder than I ever wanted to work. The good news is Rob and I, still buddies, you know, we started to hang out together when we were making bench warmers. Then we did Grown Ups, and it's all good. We were all just young then and scratching me famous, and we broke a few eggs. But I can't say there's anyone at SNL that I have any problem with that I was there with. And that was hard, because when you're in the battle like that, people are doing good, then you're doing good, then they get mad at you, and or they look at you. But to get out of there and to still be friends with everyone is actually means more than all that SNL shit.